Greatest Choice podcast, where we dive into the topics of singleness, fertility, motherhood, and choice. I'm your host, Katie B. Every episode, I'll deliver conversations with women in their fertile years who are grappling with what to do when life doesn't turn out as planned. You will also hear interviews with experts in the fields of fertility, personal development, choosing single motherhood, and more. Join us as we explore these topics and support each other along the way. Because what you decide to do with these years could be the single greatest choice you'll ever make, and you don't have to make it alone. Thanks for tuning in to the second episode of the Single Greatest Choice podcast. One of my main missions with this show is to tell the story of women whose lives haven't gone as planned. Women who've had to think about fertility and motherhood and what it means to be single in your childbearing years. It's an important conversation to me because I'm one of those women. I spent the better part of the last decade trying to first ignore and then address the ticking of my own biological clock. Today I'm going to share my story with you. As I shared with you in the last episode, I've always known I wanted to be a mom. My desire for motherhood played a big part in my early marriage at age 23 and in my divorce at 28 when my partner decided he didn't want children after all. The divorce was tough, really tough. My grief came in waves and took years to fully process. But divorce was also a huge relief. As I've grown over the past decade, I've become more and more thankful that my marriage ended when it did, because it's allowed me to grow in a particular direction and become a person I don't think I could have been if we'd stayed together. So I'm thankful, but it was hard. Dating was hard too. I've literally been on hundreds of first dates. I've tried every app, gone to countless social functions, been set up, prayed, journaled, been counseled and coached. You name it, I've tried it. And I've met a lot of really great people in the process. I've never had a hard time connecting with people, and there have been opportunities where I probably could have settled. There have also been months and even years when I thought I was ready to find my person, but I had blockages of my own that were getting in the way. I've spent too long in the wrong relationships, and I've been closed off to opportunities that might have been the right ones. I've done the best I could, but God, was it exhausting. Dating has been especially exhausting in these last few years as the pressure of the biological clock became more real. For me, I got to a point where it was nearly impossible to hear anything other than the blaring sirens of my own fertility fears. I mentioned before that my fertility journey started with an at-home ovarian reserve kit that I purchased on a whim. I got the results of this test the day after an incredible first date, and just about 2 months before my 37th birthday. The results showed that my AMH levels were right on the line between average and low for my age. That was enough to get me to schedule an appointment with a reproductive endocrinologist. My first appointment was in July 2018, the month of my 37th birthday. We did blood work and a baseline ultrasound and talked about the logistics of freezing my eggs. The process was expensive, but between my flex spending account and the generosity of my dad, it was doable. At that point, I was in a new relationship and things were going pretty well. I figured I'd do a round of egg freezing and that would take the pressure off the relationship and buy me some time to get to know him and decide if we were right for each other. I can't remember exactly why it took a few months to get things going, but I didn't start an egg retrieval cycle until October of 2018. The baseline data indicated that we might be able to retrieve about 14 to 16 eggs, which was lower than some women my age, but still a pretty good number. Before I move forward, let me explain a little bit about how egg freezing works, in case you're not familiar. Egg freezing is essentially the first half of IVF, or in vitro fertilization. During a normal cycle, the ovaries produce follicles, which are fluid-filled sacs that each contain an immature egg or oocyte. During the first half of the cycle, one of these eggs will mature and be released from the follicle at the time of ovulation. The rest of the follicles disintegrate, while the one follicle that released the egg turns into something called a corpus luteum, and it releases hormones to support a potential pregnancy during that cycle. So, in a regular cycle, one egg equals one potential pregnancy. But you don't want to go through surgery just to retrieve one egg. In an egg retrieval cycle, the goal is to produce as many mature eggs as possible. Injectable drugs are used to encourage all of the follicles to produce mature eggs, rather than just one. The process is limited by the number of follicles a woman's body volunteers in that given month. As a woman ages, that number decreases. It does fluctuate a bit from month to month, with some months being better than others, but the overall trend is downward, so younger is definitely better if you're thinking about freezing your eggs. So back to my story. The doctor predicted, based on my ultrasound and blood work, that we could expect about 14 to 16 mature eggs during my retrieval. I went in for an ultrasound on day 3 of my cycle to check that everything was quiet, meaning no cysts or other issues that might affect the process. And then I started nightly injections of several medications meant to coax those follicles into maturing my eggs. When I went back for an ultrasound a few days later, I got some not great news. Even though there were plenty of slow-growing follicles visible, I had 5 that were responding more quickly to the drugs and outpacing the rest. For an egg retrieval, you need all of the eggs to mature simultaneously so that you're ready to retrieve all of them and freeze them at the same time. If I'd kept going with that cycle, the greatest number we could have gotten would be 5. Studies estimate that it takes roughly 20 to 25 eggs to produce one live birth, so 5 was a very disappointing number. My doctor suggested we cancel the cycle, and I agreed. He thought my ovarian potential, though low for my age, was better than what we were seeing that round. I stopped the drugs and waited for the next cycle. The next month, I had an ovarian cyst, likely a side effect of the drugs I'd been injecting. So I had to get on birth control and wait another month. By that time, we were into December and the holidays, so I decided to wait until January to try again. All this time, from June to January, I'd been dating the guy I'd met back in the summer. We connected easily and really enjoyed being together, but both of us felt like something was kind of off. We spent a lot of time together, but it didn't really feel like it was going anywhere. It was hard to tell if it was because we weren't right for each other, or if it had to do with my increasing anxiety over my fertility situation. It's hard to grow a relationship in a pressure cooker, which is kind of what it felt like we were doing. Low ovarian reserve, low responder to fertility drugs. On top of everything else, my doctor kept pressing the point that freezing embryos was far more successful than freezing eggs. An embryo, by the way, is the little cluster of cells produced when an egg is fertilized by sperm and begins to grow. Embryos are hardier because even if a few cells are damaged in the freeze and thaw process, they can regenerate. Eggs, on the other hand, are single cells, so they're more vulnerable to the freezing process. They also cannot be tested for genetic abnormalities, while embryos can. As women age, fertility declines in 2 distinct ways, in quantity and in quality. We already know that my quantity was declining since my body was volunteering fewer follicles per cycle and my AMH levels were decreasing. But there was no way to know about my egg quality without fertilizing the eggs. So even if I did manage to get 14 to 16 eggs, we wouldn't know if they were healthy until we tried to fertilize them, which could be years down the road if I kept waiting for Mr. Right. And by then, it could be too late to retrieve more eggs from my already diminishing supply if the ones I'd frozen didn't work out. I'll never know if all the pressure was the reason or just one of the reasons. But in January 2019, the guy and I broke up, just days before I started the stimulations for my second attempt at freezing eggs. The second attempt wasn't much better than the first. Again, follicles numbering in the teens were visible on the ultrasound. Again, only a small number of those responded to the drugs and grew accordingly. There were 7 eggs maturing, and since that number was larger than the first attempt, my doctor recommended that we go through with the retrieval. So we did. This is the part of my story I wish I could go back and redo. This part right after the first egg retrieval. This is the place where I didn't know what I didn't know. Where I was extremely vulnerable and emotional and scared. Honestly, this part of my journey, it's the part that inspires me to share all of this with you. I want you to know what I didn't. I want you to have options I couldn't see. I hope more than anything that me sharing this part of my story will help you to get clear on what you truly want and then to make the right decisions for you. Here's what I believed about myself in January of 2019. My chances of ever becoming a biological mother were literally slipping through my fingertips with every month that went by. I had lowering ovarian reserve. I did not respond well to fertility drugs. And I was single again. I could go through another difficult, expensive egg retrieval, but the odds were that I would end up with a similar outcome. And doubling my number of frozen eggs from 7 to 14 without knowing anything about their quality, that really did not feel like a solution. Since I was feeling hopeless about preserving my eggs, it seemed like the only thing to do was to put them to use now, whether or not I was ready. I knew enough to know that it was useless to try to get back out there in the dating world with this kind of pressure. I couldn't bring the kind of energy it takes to attract another human being when I was practically drowning in fear. And I hadn't just spent the last decade having super high standards in my dating decisions just to latch on to the next guy who came along because I was worried about my fertility. I had run out of runway. Time was up. The thing I had been most afraid of since my divorce was actually happening. I hadn't beaten the clock, and now my only chance at motherhood was to be willing to go it alone. Let me just pause to say that all of these thoughts were choices. They certainly didn't feel like it at the time, but they were. Some of them were being fed to me by my doctor, and they really felt like fact, but they were only his version of what was possible for me. I was absolutely living in fear and scarcity, and it drove every decision I made at this time. What I'm not saying is that I should have buried my head in the sand and pretended like I had years and years to find my partner and have biological children. There are facts involved, actual circumstances. My AMH was decreasing. I didn't have as many follicles as other women my age, and the ones I did have were stubborn when it came to stimulating in response to drugs. But I wasn't able to be honest with myself about the fact that I wasn't ready to jump into single motherhood. I allowed myself to be carried by a current of fear rather than believing that there might be a better solution. Here's what I wish I would have done. I wish I had gotten a second opinion. I wish I had found a doctor who was willing to switch up my protocol until we found a way to get more of my follicles to respond to the medications. I wish I'd done a second retrieval, and then, because I was already considering that I might choose single motherhood, I wish I would have fertilized half of whatever eggs were collected from those two retrievals with donor sperm. That way, I would have had an idea of my egg quality, but I wouldn't have felt the same pressure to get pregnant right away. A lot of the pressure I felt was coming from knowing I wanted two children, not just one. By taking the next step to fertilize eggs, I would have potentially had embryos to use when and if I decided to go the single motherhood route, but I wouldn't have had to use them immediately. I could have possibly created enough embryos for both baby number one and a sibling, or none of my eggs could have been viable, but then I would have known. I could have gotten more information about my eggs if I'd understood more about how these things work, but I did not. And I was scared. I didn't know what to ask, and I didn't know who to trust. I let fear and my doctor drive me to a decision that, in hindsight, I really wasn't ready to make. In January 2019, shortly after my mildly successful egg retrieval, I decided to try to get pregnant through intrauterine insemination, or IUI, using donor sperm. This is basically the good old-fashioned turkey baster method, but in a doctor's office. The chances of success are alarmingly low, from about 10 to 20% per cycle. But many women do manage to get pregnant through IUI if they're willing to try for multiple cycles. I chose an OpenID donor from one of the major cryobanks. OpenID means that the donor has agreed to be contacted by any potential offspring when they turn 18. I really liked the donor I chose. He was Australian and had a PhD in engineering. He was a little nerdy, but cute. His voice in the recorded interview was warm and friendly, and he had features that resembled my family, which I thought might make it easier for my child. I bought up all the remaining vials for this donor. In March 2019, I had my first IUI. I understood that the odds of success were fairly low, so I wasn't too disheartened when I got a negative pregnancy test at home 2 weeks after the procedure. The fertility clinic requires a blood test after each IUI, and I was shocked to get the call after my first beta test that I actually was testing positive for pregnancy, though my numbers were really low. The clinic had me come back 2 days later to see if my HCG hormone levels had gone up or down. Up would indicate pregnancy, while down would indicate what's called a chemical pregnancy, or a very early miscarriage. A chemical pregnancy is one that does not progress far enough to be visible on an ultrasound, but enough happens in the body to create HCG, a hormone that is only detectable during pregnancy. 2 days later, my HCG had gone down, a chemical pregnancy. I honestly was not too disheartened. I thought it was a good sign that something had happened since this was my first ever try to get pregnant. Maybe the old ovaries just needed to be kicked into gear. I was hopeful for the next cycle, but the IUI in April was unsuccessful as well. And at that point, I had to go back to the drawing board with donors because I was out of vials. Choosing a donor the second time was much harder and more depressing. The momentum was beginning to wear off, and the donor choices were less than compelling. I ultimately ended up choosing a donor who I had eliminated in the first go-around because I didn't think he seemed very smart. He was okay, the best I could find at the time, so I pulled the trigger and bought two more vials. At this point, we were headed into May of 2019. My relationship had ended back in January, but in February, we'd agreed to hang out casually while I was trying to conceive. We weren't sure what was going to happen when I eventually got pregnant, but since it can be a long process, we didn't think there was any harm in spending time together in the meantime. It seemed innocent at the time, but more time with less pressure meant that our connection grew in ways it couldn't when we were officially dating. My plan to get pregnant on my own was still clear in my head, but it was becoming less clear in my heart. I did another IUI in May, but this time with much less conviction. I was pretty ambivalent about whether it was successful, and it was very telling that I was actually relieved when the blood test came back negative. I started to wonder if maybe I should take a break from trying to conceive and give my relationship more of a chance to grow. I was trying to process all of this with the guy, but it was a lot for him to take in. After May, I decided to take a break from the IUIs for a while. I felt equal parts relieved and anxious. Wasting even a single month of precious fertility felt risky. But then things intensified with the guy and he said he needed a break. To me, it felt final, like we were breaking up all over again. We went without communicating for the longest stretch of time since we'd met each other a year before. I was aware that I was nearing my ovulation date. I hadn't had any monitoring or medication, but I was feeling antsy about skipping a cycle, especially now that I felt even more single than I had for the past few months. I had one vial of donor number 2 left, the donor that I didn't really love. I was also at my wit's end with my doctor, who was abrupt and egotistical, prone to power plays, and emotionally manipulative. I thought, I'll do a Hail Mary IUI this month and use up that last vial. Then, in July, I'll find a new doctor and a new donor. I decided I would even be open to trying fertility medication like letrozole or Clomid, something that I'd been avoiding so far because I was so terrified of the possibility of twins. So I called the clinic on June 13th, and 2 days later I was back in the office for an IUI. Even the doctor said it was unlikely to work. He was pretty salty about the fact that I'd broken protocol by coming in for just the IUI without any of the preliminary monitoring. He even charged me $250 more for that cycle, even though I'd have significantly less care from his clinic. I did the IUI and then basically forgot about it. I was so sure it wasn't going to work that I didn't take any of the normal precautions. I got in a chlorinated pool on the same day as the procedure, which could have killed the sperm. I did hot yoga, I took ibuprofen, I even had a glass of wine or two. I felt like there was a 0% chance that the IUI had worked, but I was glad I had done it just to wrap up my time at that doctor's clinic and make a clean break for the next month. A few days after the IUI, I got a call from the guy. Rather than being completely done with whatever it was we were doing, he'd been thinking about what it would be like for us to actually try dating again. I knew in my heart the moment he said those words that that's what I wanted. It would mean putting the baby stuff on hold for a while, but maybe it would be worth it. I wasn't ready to be a mom all on my own. I didn't want my baby to share DNA with a stranger if he could have a real dad instead. I was all in, except I had to tell the guy about the IUI I'd done in June, even though I'd said I was going to take a break. I was honest about the fact that I'd done it, but I was also certain it wasn't going to work, just like the other three hadn't. Even though he understood why I'd moved forward with the unplanned procedure, the guy was stunned and hurt and disoriented. It changed things. I don't know if we could have rebounded from that IUI if it hadn't worked, and I'll never know because it did work. A few days before my 2-week wait was up, I took a pregnancy test, fully expecting it to be negative. It wasn't. The pink line was clear as day. I was definitely pregnant. I wish I could say that my desire to be a mother managed to trump the messy road that had led me to that pregnancy. It didn't. At least, not at first. I was devastated. I cried. My whole body shook. I lay in bed for hours, paralyzed. Was I really going to spend my life as a single mother when the relationship I longed for felt so close? And the donor? How, with my pick of any sperm donor on the internet, had I landed with one I wasn't even excited about? How would I explain that to my child? Even if I did end up becoming a single mother by choice, I had convinced myself that I did not want donor number 2 to be my child's biological father. Even in those early moments of panic and despair, I knew I was going to be okay. I knew that my thoughts were creating my feelings and that I just had to have compassion for myself and gently redirect my brain to thoughts that would make me feel better. I was pregnant, and even though I desperately wanted things to work out with the guy, I had to be honest with myself. We had known each other for a year at that point and not managed to create the relationship that either of us desired. I could choose to believe that he was not my forever guy. And I could also believe that if he was, he would still love me, baby and all. I spiraled in and out of sadness and acceptance, excitement and grief. I was gentle with myself and gave myself permission to both regret my decision and embrace this new reality. The problem was, it didn't feel real at all. I went through the motions of telling a few close friends and family members, but it was hard because I couldn't match their level of excitement. The pregnancy felt like a lie, and I felt like a disappointment for not being over the moon. Around the time I was 5 weeks pregnant, I went on a solo trip to New England. It was part work and part pleasure. I spent a beautiful sunny weekend in Portland, Maine, walking around the wharf and watching boats come into the harbor. I tried to talk to my baby, to connect with this little being who was growing inside of me. I even bought the most precious little baby outfit, but I felt like a fraud doing it. None of it felt real. When I got back from the trip, I went in for my second ultrasound. The first ultrasound had confirmed a yolk sac, but the fetal pole was still too small to see. The second ultrasound was supposed to show a heartbeat. I was hopeful that seeing a beating heart would make the pregnancy feel more real to me, but there was no heartbeat. The yolk sac, which provides nourishment for the embryo, was growing right on course, but the embryo, the actual baby, was not developing. This made total sense to me. I wasn't able to connect with my baby because there was no baby. Something was happening in my body, but I knew in my gut that whatever it was not a viable pregnancy. I didn't cry. I wasn't shocked. I wasn't sure yet what that experience was there to teach me, but I was at peace with the fact that it was never supposed to bring me a baby. I won't get into the weeds about what happened next, but I'll just say that the next few weeks were not as clear as I'd always assumed miscarriage to be. I had no idea that one could be ambiguously pregnant, but that's kind of what I was. My body continued to think I was pregnant. The yolk sac kept growing and my HCG kept going up. For several weeks, I went in for ultrasounds every few days to try to determine if, in fact, I was actually viably pregnant. It was clear that the chances were slim, but they were still there. And it seemed like the more likely miscarriage became, the more hopeful I became that the pregnancy might survive. We waited until almost 9 weeks pregnant to schedule a DNC. I was hopeful after the miscarriage that I would have a chance to explore a relationship with the guy I'd been seeing throughout the past year. But he was understandably freaked out about the pregnancy and the subsequent miscarriage, so it seemed that I had blown my opportunity. We continue to have a close relationship, but moving forward as a couple was pretty clearly off the table at that point. I moved forward with finding a new donor, and this time I managed to find one that I loved. He didn't look anything like my family, but he seemed smart, and more importantly, he seemed kind. I loved the story of how he chose his career, and we share interests in personal development, yoga, and meditation. Knowing that my child may want to reach out to the donor later in life, I felt good about imagining this guy on the receiving end of that phone call or email. I was actually excited that my future child would share this guy's DNA. I had to wait for a while for my body to bounce back from the miscarriage. HCG takes a remarkably long time to flush out of the system. In September 2019, I got the go-ahead from my doctor to try another IUI. At this point, I'd moved over to my regular OBGYN's office rather than staying with that reproductive endocrinologist who made me feel so uncomfortable. I did 2 cycles of IUI with letrozole in September and October. I was so sure they would work now that the stars had aligned. Better donor, better doctor, more clarity in my relationship status. But both IUIs were unsuccessful. 6 IUIs with donor sperm is not an inexpensive venture. A vial of sperm costs around $1,000 plus shipping. Then the procedure itself costs another $300 to $500. And my hospital bills for the DNC and all the extra ultrasounds were not cheap either. This project was really adding up, and it felt like I wasn't getting anywhere. I decided to move to IVF, or in vitro fertilization, with the hopes that things would begin to move a bit quicker. My regular OBGYN pointed me in the direction of a fertility clinic that felt like a much better fit for me than where I had started. I linked up with a fantastic female doctor. If you or someone you love are trying to conceive, you should definitely check out her podcast, As a Woman, by Dr. Natalie Crawford. I've got it linked in the resources on my website, and I'll put it in the show notes as well. Working with Dr. Crawford changed everything for me. I no longer felt hopeless. I felt empowered and positive, like it was entirely possible to create the life I wanted for myself. She was the first person to ask what my family planning goals actually were. My last doctor never asked me how many children I wanted, or whether it was more important to me to be a mom soon, or to preserve eggs to use with a future partner. He made me feel like I needed to grab onto whatever I could get and just be thankful if I managed to have a baby at all. He actually commented one time that I just didn't seem very desperate to become a mom when I tried to think about different scenarios, some of which involved postponing motherhood. Ugh. Dr. Crawford, on the other hand, offered me options. She was frank and real, no sugarcoating, but she also involved me in my own fertility planning. Imagine that. It was an entirely different experience from my first clinic, and I'm so thankful that I found her and her team. I hope you hear that there are lots of different practices out there, and if you don't feel heard and respected in your current situation, it is absolutely in your best interest to move. Even if it costs you time and money to change clinics, it may completely change your story. For me, it changed everything. I only wish I had made the move earlier in the game. With Dr. Crawford, I ranked my priorities. Number one, be a mom, period. Number two, preserve the ability to have more than one child, preferably with the same donor if both children were donor conceived. Number three, preserve the possibility of having a biological child with a partner down the road. Based on those priorities, we decided our next move would be another egg retrieval. The protocol was roughly the same as the first retrieval I'd done in January 2019, but with an increase in my dosages of Follistim and Minipure and the addition of human growth hormone. In December 2019, I went through egg retrieval number two and harvested 8 eggs. 7 of those eggs were mature. The embryologist thawed the 7 eggs that I'd frozen back in January, which we'd moved over from my previous clinic. 5 of those survived the thaw, so I had 12 eggs total. We fertilized all of them with donor sperm. I literally put all of my eggs in one basket. We'd chosen this strategy because it seemed like it was most likely to accomplish goal number one, become a mom, and possibly goal number two, have enough embryos for a sibling. It did wipe out the possibility of goal number three, save eggs for a potential future partner, but at this point, it didn't feel like it was possible for me to have it all. The standard recommendation is 20 to 25 eggs for one live birth, so my measly 12 eggs might not even be enough to bring me one good embryo, much less a sibling. It didn't seem wise to set anything aside given what we had to work with. The embryologist fertilized my eggs with the sperm from donor number 3 on the same day as my retrieval. All 12 eggs fertilized. This was a good sign. I waited for 5 days to get an update on how many were still growing. A typical outcome would be about half, so I was hoping for 6 embryos, but honestly, I was expecting fewer. I was convinced I had poor egg quality. But by day 5, 8 embryos were still growing. Amazing. On day 5 post-fertilization, the remaining embryos were biopsied. A small collection of cells were taken from each one, and then they were frozen, and the cells were sent off for genetic testing. Again, the expectation is that the number that comes back normal will be half or less. I was fully expecting my number to be lower than average because of the chemical pregnancy after IUI number 1 and the miscarriage after IUI number 4. Those were likely both caused by abnormalities in my egg cells, so I wasn't hopeful. I was terrified that all 8 embryos would come back abnormal. I was also anxious about what to do if I had only one good embryo. Should I move forward with a transfer, knowing that that pregnancy might be my one and only? Or should I spend thousands more dollars trying to create additional embryos before getting pregnant? It turns out I thankfully did not have to make that choice. I vividly remember the moment that I got the email with my embryo biopsy results. I was in the Verizon store, of all places, upgrading my iPhone. While I waited for the clerk to go get my new phone from the back, I opened my email on autopilot. As soon as I saw the subject line, I knew what it was. I did have the momentary thought that the Verizon store might not be the place to learn such life-altering news, but I've never been very good at waiting. I opened the email and immediately burst into tears. Tears of joy streamed down my face as the clerk returned with my new iPhone, looking understandably very confused. 5. 5! I had 5 perfectly growing, genetically normal embryos. I could not believe my good fortune. I was over the moon. This was far beyond what I or my doctor or any of the statistics had predicted. It really goes to show how important it is not to pay too much attention to anyone else's outcome on your own fertility journey. My first doctor acted like those 7 frozen eggs were nothing, but of the 5 that survived the thaw, 2 became healthy embryos. Another batch of 7 eggs, retrieved 10 months later, led to another 3 embryos. Around the same time, comedian Amy Schumer was speaking very publicly about her own IVF journey to create embryos for a second baby down the line. Amy is exactly my age and recently gave birth to her first child. I have no idea if she had any fertility help the first go around, but it makes sense that she'd consider IVF now if she wants to have some space between her pregnancies. The reason I bring her up is that our ages are similar, but our outcomes were very different. Her doctor retrieved 35 eggs in one retrieval. Of those 35, 26 fertilized. So at that point, she had more than double my 12. But in the end, only one of her eggs led to a genetically normal embryo, whereas I have 5 embryos from less than half the number of fertilized eggs. There's no clear reason why outcomes vary so drastically. There's also little correlation between quality and quantity, other than the fact that they both decrease with age. Amy had high quantity, but low quality. I, on the other hand, had low quantity, but high quality. And while quantity can be somewhat predicted by hormone levels, quality really cannot. Imagine if Amy had frozen her 35 eggs without fertilizing and testing them, assuming that they would be enough for 2 children down the road. She would have been heartbroken when she finally decided to use them. I, on the other hand, felt pretty hopeless about my 7 measly frozen eggs, but they led to 2 good embryos. So stopping the preservation process at just freezing eggs can be very problematic because you really don't know what you've got until you fertilize and test them. But that can be problematic because it means that you have to know where your sperm is coming from. And some of us are not ready to make that choice, so freezing eggs is the best we can do. These are the exact little tidbits of knowledge that drive my desire to produce this podcast. I've learned so much, and I hope that what I share can be helpful to some of you. Okay, back to my story. So it's Christmas, and I had just received the best gift, the gift of some level of security. I could finally breathe for the first time in a year. Nothing in the fertility world is ever 100% guaranteed, but I was feeling pretty good about my 5 little Frosties. The success rate for a PGS normal embryo is about 70%, so I could be pretty certain that my baby was there in that batch, and probably a sibling too if I wanted. It was in considering which embryo to transfer that the next wave of emotion came. Now let me just say that I understand that I was sitting in a place of extreme privilege at this point. So many women would not have had the financial or emotional resources to get to this point with all of the IUIs and the egg retrievals I'd done. Others have gone through much more in the way of fertility treatments, and they'd give anything to have just one good embryo, and now I had 5. So I know that I should have just been happy with what I had and let it be enough. It's funny how powerful our thoughts are in times like this. It's funny how opposite things can be true. I was thrilled. I really, really was. And also, I pieced together the fact that the embryo I was most likely to transfer had come from one of my fresh eggs. 3 of the embryos had. I understood that I hadn't really needed to thaw my frozen eggs. I could have potentially saved those frozen eggs in case I meet a partner later down the road, and I still would have ended up with all the embryos I needed now. This realization was interesting from a self-coaching perspective. From the moment I discovered where each of my 5 embryos came from, I saw that I could literally switch back and forth between opposing but true lines of thinking, and that what I thought changed how I was feeling about everything. I could think, "This is amazing. I have more than I ever thought was possible. My sweet baby's specific code of DNA has been created, and I'm that much closer to meeting him or her. This is amazing." Those thoughts made me feel incredible. I was elated, on cloud 9, over the moon. But sometimes I also thought, all of my eggs are fertilized with donor sperm. I don't have the money to do another retrieval. If I move forward with a transfer and it's successful, it will be a while before I think about dating again. That means even if I do meet a partner someday, it will probably be too late to have a child that shares his DNA. When I thought about it that way, my heart sank. I felt heavy and sad, as if I was watching a lifelong dream die. It was the worst. Even though I was a bit heartbroken, I was mostly relieved and grateful for my 5 little embryos. This was the first time in the year-long journey that I had allowed myself to truly believe motherhood was near. And I was ready. I even started buying baby clothes. I allowed myself to fall in love with the tiny cluster of cells and to get excited. I was still doing lots of self-coaching on the 2 areas that didn't feel great. The thought that I had no more eggs available for the future, well, other than the ones in my body, of course, and thoughts about what it would really mean for my child to have a donor instead of a dad. All of my concerns about identity issues and the strange realities of donor siblings felt more real now that my embryos were real. I already loved them so much, and I was worried that the way I'd chosen to create them could potentially cause them pain. I was talking to a reproductive psychologist about both of these issues, and between that and my own self-coaching tools, I knew that it was only a matter of time before I could let go of those thoughts and focus more on the excitement than the fear and the sadness. It's all a choice. It takes discipline and intention, but we create our realities one thought at a time. I planned to transfer for early February 2020, which was the first opportunity after my embryo news in late December. I had a mock transfer in January, where the doctor fills up the uterine cavity with saline to make sure everything looks good for the real transfer. All systems were go, and I ordered another $1,600 of fertility meds, which I really hoped would be my last over-the-top conception expense for a while. I was excited. I shared my news with a few close friends and my family, and I marked February 4th on my calendar. I started planning the nursery and thinking about maternity leave. I bought more cute baby clothes. I put all my energy into believing that the transfer was going to work the first time and that I would have my sweet baby in my arms by the fall of 2020. I also shared my news with the guy. You know, the one who'd been in my life all this time, who wasn't a partner, but was still kind of more than a friend. I told him about my transfer plans, and I also told him about my fears. I shared my sadness about fertilizing all of my frozen eggs and how I wished I had saved some for a potential future partner. He listened as usual with his calm, steady support. And a few days later, he made a proposal. He said that he would like to help me by paying for another egg retrieval before my transfer. You guys, what in the world? Who does that? It was an incredible offer, so, of course, I said no. That level of generosity seriously floored me. How could I even accept such an enormous gift? I knew that our financial situations were very different, and that a number that is huge to me is not as big a deal to him. But still, my brain went in a million different directions, trying to find the trap, to understand how saying yes would somehow be detrimental to him or to me or to both of us. I didn't want to do anything that could potentially damage our friendship. But I know him, and I know he wouldn't have offered if he wasn't clear on his motives and firm in his decision. The next morning, after a sleepless night of thinking about the possibility, I played an audio recording of affirmations that I created for myself. One of the statements is, "I always, always, always have more than enough." As soon as I heard those words, I burst into tears. More than enough. That's what I've been actively trying to call into my life. More than enough time, more than enough money, more than enough love, energy, wisdom, friendship. I was actively trying to create and claim and be grateful for abundance in all areas of my life. It didn't make sense to turn down more than enough when the universe presented it to me so clearly. I already felt like I had more than enough with my 5 embryos. I had been trying to tamp down the voice that was fearful about closing the door to having a child with a partner and just be grateful that I could have a child at all. And here, someone who cared about me was offering me more than enough. It was unbelievable. So I said yes. On February 4th, 2020, I did a third egg retrieval instead of an embryo transfer. And guess what? This time, I got 12 eggs. That's as many as I had from the first 2 cycles combined. And because I had fertilized the eggs from the previous cycles, I can be relatively certain of the quality of my eggs. That means that even if I don't return to them for several years, the likelihood that they could produce a quality embryo is pretty high. I feel ridiculously lucky. Now that I have 5 embryos and 12 eggs on ice, I've decided to take a little break. I doubt it will last long because I really do want to be a mom. I feel ready in a way that I didn't when I started all of this. I'm thankful and honestly not surprised that I didn't get pregnant when I was trying to conceive from a place of fear and scarcity. Now I know that when I do transfer one of my embryos, it will be because I want to, because I'm ready and I'm choosing to become a mom on my own terms. This is the freedom that I want for you. Your path may look different from mine, but whatever choices you make, I want you to be able to make them from a place of knowledge, power, strength, and abundance. I don't want lack of understanding about your fertility options to stand in your way, and I really don't want you to be frozen in place because you're too afraid to look at these issues of singleness, fertility, motherhood, and choice straight in the eye. I want to help you claim the life you want to live and to support you in the choices that'll help you to get there. I've got big plans for this community and ideas about how we can support each other, but you'll have to wait to hear more about that. In the meantime, I hope you'll tune in to upcoming episodes where I'll be interviewing women who have also had to face their own big decisions about what to do when life doesn't go as planned. I hope these stories bring you strength and make you feel a little less alone on the journey. Until next time, thanks for listening. Thank you for joining me for this episode of the Single Greatest Choice podcast. I'm your host, Katie B. You can learn about me and this project on my website, singlegreatestchoice.com. That's also the place to go if you're interested in being a future podcast guest. If you enjoyed today's episode, please take a minute to rate and review in iTunes. That helps more women to find our show. Until next time, I'm sending you all my love and support as you go about making the choices that will create a life you love.